thanks, Claire. Thanks so much for agreeing to this interview. I think it's going to be a great bridge between the situation is this, the speaker series that we did, and our Future is Floating program. And one of the motivations behind the Future is Floating, in addition to its speculative nature, is that it provides a responsive counterpoint to our larger projects that require considerable planning and strategizing and maneuvering in order to realize. So before we move to talking about your current major project, I wondered if you could give our listeners an outline of the origin of Situations.
Yes, of course. Situations began back in 2002, so in fact it's 10 years old this year. And my background was as a curator in galleries. So I came out of a period of time when in the UK, curating was going through quite a big change. Lots of galleries and buildings were being shut down and refurbished. And as a result, I did a lot of work out in the public realm as a curator, and found that that's sort of where my passion lay, that I was really interested in this burgeoning field of art practice amongst some emerging artists within the UK, even though, of course, it had a decade of history in terms of artists working in the public realm. And I was interested in whether or not I could set up a commissioning model, an art commissioning model, within a research context. I was particularly interested when I was working as a curator that so often we were working on a kind of conveyor belt of projects to projects, and there was very little time for critical thinking about what we were doing. And I was at the time enjoying doing a lot of writing and theoretical reflection on some of the work that I was doing. So it started as a pilot at the University of the West of England in Bristol. I had a part-time job there as a research fellow, and we did it for 2 years and basically combined public art commissions, some temporary projects, with a lecture program and a publication, which led to From Studio to Situation. And after that, from 2005 onwards, it became a permanent full-time program where we had parallel strands of activity going, where we, at one point we might be working on highly spontaneous, very temporary intervention, and on another major project, perhaps over 3 years working on a permanent public art program. And over that period of time, what's been the overriding driving force has been trying to expand the notion of going from site specificity to situation specificity, really, which is understanding how artists work with and intervene with a public realm, and the public realm as defined not simply by its geographic limits, but by its conditions of social, economic, and political conditions. And in doing so, we've had lots of research projects and publications are part of what we do. And I see very much the commissioning being impacted by the publishing and the research, and vice versa. So it's there's sort of an ecology of working which feeds research and commissioning as part of that.
Yeah, is that tied to your experience in operating in partnership with an academic institution? I mean, could you reflect a little bit on that model?
Yes, I mean, I think probably it's the same in Canada, but over the last 10 years, universities have become very different places to work. Certainly when I began, there was a strong emphasis on practice-led research, so it was a very fertile ground on which to test out ideas of how we commission and work in the public realm. Less so now, I'd say. I think there's more emphasis in the UK, certainly, on vocational training and the idea of entrepreneurship as opposed to perhaps practice-led research. But as a result, I think what was very interesting in terms of the organisational model that got set up was that it allowed me to say, well, listen, we're going to take 2 years to develop this project because that's what it needs, and we'll go silent while we do that. And I think that's quite a normal thing within universities. If you're researching, you might research for 2 years on the ground, in field work, etc., and then the public output comes out after that. Whereas in the gallery sector, you know, there is a sort of overproduction tendency, perhaps, sort of notion of you have to be visible all the time. So I think that was a very influential way of working. We've now decided to, after 10 years, to leave the university and to become an independent arts organisation. And the reason for doing that was that our projects have become larger scale. They're much, much more difficult to produce through university operating systems. But also our research partnerships are now much more outward facing. So, for example, it's likely that we'll have research partnerships with other universities, and therefore the model that we really needed was to have a kind of production commissioning organisation that has research partnerships, as opposed to an organisation that's embedded within a university.
Yes. Are there other organisations that kind of inspired this change?
Well, it's interesting. I think there are organisations that inspired us from the very beginning. So Creative Time is an enormous influence on how we work, I think, and Art Angel equally in London. Less so in terms of academic institutions. We did look at other models of how perhaps we could develop in the future. So we looked at things like there's a project called People's Palace Projects, which is part of Queen Mary College in London, which is run actually as a spin-out company in relation to a university. And we did look at that model, but actually financially it's quite difficult to do that being a charity in the UK. So it was actually easier to set ourselves up independently. But I don't know of many other models where you have an arts organisation that has a very strong research emphasis in the way in which I hope situations will continue to do.
Right, and this new approach, does it kind of herald a new public role?
Yes, I mean, it's an interesting one because we will continue to do international projects. And as you might know, we produced this large-scale project in New Zealand called One Day Sculpture in 2008-09. And in fact, next year, over the next 4 years, we're delivering a big program of projects in Oslo in Norway. So we will continue to do international projects, but I see our role, our Bristol base in the southwest region, being very, very important. And so I think we'll have a much more visible role as an arts organisation than we have done before. And of course, there's a reason also why we need to do that, because we will need to be raising public funding towards what we do. So whereas it might have been easier in the past to go silent for a couple of years, it will become less easy to do that, I think.
And your sort of projections for partnerships, will they go beyond the public sector? Do you anticipate working more closely with private organizations or businesses?
Yes, that's an interesting one. One of the things that I'm very, very careful about is that situations could very easily become simply a public art consultancy. Now, the mixed economy model that we've sort of pioneered here in the last couple of years has been to say we want to be an arts organisation with a public focus to what we do, and we want to test the limits of what's thought of as public art. But we think we can do that by still working within the parameters of public art consultancies that are on offer. So often what happens is we form a partnership perhaps with a private developer, or maybe we're doing work at the moment for the University of Bristol, and we might tender for something to curate a particular project. But when we win that tender, we negotiate to form a partnership rather than a service agreement. And I think that's one of the things that I'm working very hard on, is to say actually the difference is that as an arts organisation, we bring a commitment to public engagement. We bring a commitment to testing the limits of what's possible, as opposed to just delivering a service to a client. So it's quite a sort of nuanced thing. But I think a number of arts organisations, certainly in the UK, are undertaking that kind of mixed economy funding, because that's the reality, you know, in which we're all working. And it's trying to do what we always wanted to do, but within a different economic climate, I think.
Yeah, I think that really brings up where the primary focus of an organization resides. And I've always been interested in how public art organizations balance their relationships with artists and the relationships with audiences or publics. So, for instance, Creative Time's mission is very artist-centered and states the public space is a space for creativity and free expression. Other organizations focus much more on the reception of the work and its transformative potential for audiences. For me, these differing approaches are tied to the context of funding, as well as balancing the values of artistic autonomy and community. And how do you navigate that terrain?
Well, certainly I would absolutely agree with you in that I think it you have to approach it on a project-by-project basis. That said, I think what's quite interesting is that when you look back over 10 years of work, you can see a sort of pattern emerging, a characteristic, even though the projects might be very different in their execution or their the ways in which they've engaged public, for example. What I would say is that the best way of describing what happens in a situations project is to say that it begins with a remarkable idea from an artist. That's always the way in which it begins. Now, that might be in response to an opportunity, let's say a commissioning brief, but it doesn't go anywhere until you've got that kind of hook, that initial catalyst of an idea from an artist. And my job is to kind of, throughout the process, protect that idea and find a way for it to live and to become realized. But what happens is that as a result of that, my job is also to make sure that that idea grows around a temporary community, however large or small that project needs it to be, as opposed to targeting a particular public. So on a number of our projects, for example, what we've seen happen is that they've grown a community of interest from lots of different networks, which forms a community around that project. And that's the way in which it reaches out to an initial public. And then sometimes what happens is it has a sort of secondary audience through anecdote if it's a temporary project, or over longer periods of time if it's a durational project over, say, 10 years. So it's interesting in that let's say within the Ecology of Bristol, the Arts Ecology of Bristol, there's definitely organisations that are much more defined according to their nurturing role for emerging artists, for example. And they have a very clear remit in that. And you could say that they're more artist-focused. But I would say we are artist-focused, but it's with a view to those projects having a life in the public realm. And one of the things that that's meant in the last 10 years has been that we've, every single time we start a project, we start from the beginning. So we start by embedding a project within a particular place or growing a particular community of people around it. And that means that we have to have a real sensitivity to aspirations for the project, both on the part of the artist and on the part of participants or audience members who get involved. It's interesting to see how a project progresses, but I would say definitely I don't see public engagement as something that occurs at the point of delivery, that it occurs through a project as it progresses, and that's how it kind of accrues this temporary community around it.
Yeah, I mean, you're basically undertaking nation building at the moment. So maybe you could talk a little bit about Nowhere Island, Alex Hartley's work.
Sure. Alex Hartley is a British artist. He had this rather beautiful, if impossible, idea, which was what would happen if an Arctic island travelled south to southwest England during the Olympics. And in doing so, it passed through international waters and therefore became a new nation, Nowhere Island. And Alex approached us back in 2009 to realise this project, to bring the island literally from Svalbard in the high Arctic, which is in the Kingdom of Norway, through international waters, and to sail it from Weymouth, which is the site of the sailing events as part of the London 2012 Olympic Games, around the southwest coast over 6 weeks to Bristol, stopping at seven ports and harbours as it went. Now, Alex is very much a studio-based artist. That's his background. His works primarily in sculpture and photography. But he knew with this project he was interested in it becoming something really quite different, that it would be both a sculpture, a floating landscape, with, of course, a heritage of Robert Smithson's Floating Island and other works of dislocation and landscape, but that it would also be a project which would very much raise the question of what if a refugee nation came to visit during the Olympic Games, and what does that have to say in terms of being a symbolic piece of territory? What does it have to say about who owns that territory, and what rules and laws and principles might found this new nation? So from the very beginning, he offered this project out to us, really, to shape it into a project that might garner that interest and support, not only regionally in Southwest England, but internationally. So when we went to the High Arctic last September to retrieve the island, we launched, and it entered international waters, we launched this project as the world's newest nation. And we had on board with us all sorts of people that helped us to begin thinking about the implications of that. So we had an environmental campaigner, Tamsin Omond. We had legal blogger Carl Gardner. We had human geographer Professor Tim Cresswell. And we had Laurie Penny, who is part of the Occupy movement. And as a result, what's happened with that project is that it's grown as a program, which is informed by people's responses. So now there's nearly 6,000 people across 85 countries who signed up to be citizens of Nowhere Island. And they've begun to shape the island's online constitution by posting propositions for the constitution, which are ranked like or dislike. And so that forms a kind of hierarchy of propositions. There's also a program, year-long program, of resident thinkers. So people from Yoko Ono to the co-founder of the Eden Project, Tim Smith, from activist Peter Tatchell to mathematician Martis de Sertoy and illustrator Kerry Smith, fellow Canadian, have all contributed letters to Nowhere Island on a weekly basis. And what we found is that those opinions, some are whimsical, some are very serious, some are calls to action, some are poetic. They are layering the project. They are almost contributing these different ideas and to what the project can be, and teasing out of it all of the implications of this piece of land moving from one jurisdiction to another. And as a result, it's become incredibly rich. Of course, regionally and locally, we've also developed partnerships with 20 organisations across the Southwest. So, for example, Nowhere Island has been used by 5 schools across their curriculum over the last 18 months. And in each of the ports and harbours, Nowhere Island will be welcomed by different host organisations. So in Plymouth, it will be welcomed by the refugee football team, Hope FC. In Newquay, it will be welcomed by a flotilla of surfers. And in Weymouth, during the opening to the London 2012 Olympic sailing events, we're actually going to have a citizen march through the town. So it's a nomadic project. It's a nomadic public art project. And one of the things I often say about it is, to really see it, you will see the island offshore, but to really see the project, you have to engage with all of these different elements. And then you start to get a sense of that the project is so much more than the physical territory, if you like.
Yeah, certainly its online presence is what is giving it this kind of spine over the arc of the project. I got my citizenship papers in the mail, so thanks.
Oh, great.
I was thrilled. And I've really been watching the online activity. It's been fascinating. This really comprehensive approach, combining the sort of promotion of the project with the letters from the resident thinkers and this collaboratively written constitution for the new nation, as well as like research opportunities. It seems like, you know, you've been combining all of these different elements to address both the challenges and the benefits of maintaining this level, ongoing level of interest in an object, which the object itself is kind of an emblem and will, as I imagine it, always be somewhat in the distance physically. So yes. Maybe could you talk a little bit about, in using digital media, how you're approaching understanding the diversity and expectations of online audiences, because of course your citizen base is international as well, and the relationship to concepts of public art, you know, are so very specific from one region to another.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing is to say it's been a huge learning curve for us. You know, I think we've learned an enormous amount, and the thing with this project is that digital media from, you know, 2010 to now has gone through such a massive change that we've almost had to run to keep up with the changes. So what's been fantastic about being a relatively small organization is we can respond really quickly. So if suddenly Pinterest takes off as a, you know, as a form of discussing ideas, we can embed that into the website next week, you know. And if Twitter has a slightly different way of doing things, we can change really quickly. So I think that's one of the things that has become really clear is for arts organizations to really embrace digital media. You have to be fleet of foot to do it. And the other thing is that you have to have dedicated people to be doing it. I mean, my team have sort of all been contributing to it, but certainly we're about to employ a new communications manager, and it's almost half of their job, full-time job now, digital media, because I recognize what a vital part of really talking through a project it is. That said, I think one of the things that I've learned a great deal is that I think a lot of arts organizations and a lot of projects use digital media and social media particularly simply to announce and market their projects and for feedback. And one of the things I've been interested in is how one can understand it as a conversation back and forth, a call and response, as opposed to just pushing stuff out there. Now, that's tough to do, and we don't always do it as well as I would hope we could do in terms of conversations about Noah Island. But certainly the online constitution, it is so much more than someone saying, I like Noah Island or I don't. It's about actually genuinely getting people to engage with the ideas and to go away and to formulate in 120 characters what proposition you would put forward to a new nation's constitution. Requires a real thinking through of your own values, of how this project might relate to your own experience. And so I think it's about that level of engagement, of really thinking, well, how does digital media enable that response to happen, and then that response to be folded back into an artwork? And that's what's become very exciting, is that the social media and digital media responses are there for others to see. So when I was at a recent arts and participation discussion in London, and in fact it was about theatre mainly, but we were discussing how engagement via digital media can actually expand an understanding of an artist's work before, during, and after the event. So for instance, in theatre, you might think about what could you do in terms of social and digital media that would build up an audience's engagement with ideas before they even come and see a performance, and then afterwards, but not simply afterwards and saying, did you like it or not, but afterwards in terms of following up particular strands of thought. So I think that the possibilities are enormous, but it does require funders to understand that that needs a very different kind of resourcing. And also for arts organizations and employers to understand that somebody in charge of a digital editor might not be a technical person. It's more likely to be a curator or an artist doing it, because you have to be able to engage with the ideas rather than simply just put things online. So that's been a really, really useful thing for us to be able to learn, really. And the other thing I would say that's really fascinating is that most of those people who sign up to be citizens, I would say, looking at the list, don't tend to be people that I recognise as being colleagues and peers in the arts sector, which tends to suggest that people who already engage with Noah Island as an artwork or a part of the professional arts sector, if you like, don't tend to sign up for things. and in fact, people that sign up for things tend to be people who have come at it from a different point of view. I mean, maybe you're sort of one of the exceptions, because I know we've got a sort of broad base of people interested in Nowhere Island who might consider themselves part of the professional art sector. But it tends to be people who have come to it perhaps because they're interested in Occupy, or they're interested in climate change, or they're interested in some of the discussions around migration and refugee, or they're simply interested in becoming a citizen of a new nation. So that's quite interesting. Somebody said to me the other day, oh, but you've only got 6,000 citizens. And I said, yes, but that's people who've really actively engaged to sign up to something with their name and their address, and they want to be a part of it. Actually, the people who are being reached for the project and engaging with it but aren't citizens, you know, that's another sort of set of people. So there is this question, I think, which is, firstly, if you're wanting to broaden access to public art commissions, I would say the wonderful thing about social media is you can reach totally different networks through that. And that's what we've done through the Resident Thinkers. So when we've had someone from Greenpeace, he's tweeted out about his letter to Nowhere Island, and of course it then reaches all of those people. Then there's the question of how you make it a really prominent and engaging project for those already committed to contemporary art and the public realm. The key with that is then that also has to be backed up by our situations, mailing lists, and making sure that there are events that really engage that set of people as well. So it's an interesting payoff between the two.
Really multiple audiences and multiple investment in what you're trying to do. I've been kind of going back and watching the popularity of different propositions and ones that I particularly like, you know, and watching them slip perhaps, and other ones come to the fore. It's really fascinating to see, because there seems to be something a little more involved than just hitting the thumbs up, thumbs down. There's also within the Constitution this capacity to throw in some whimsical or impossible or kind of surrealistic things, like skiing is voluntary, or...
Yeah, I love that. From a Norwegian.
Or juries will consist of no less than 50% of the population. The practicalities of this are purposefully skirted over.
Yeah.
So there's this capacity for imagination that sits, you know, next to I'm thinking this is yours. Every Nowherian has the right to be heard, which is very, very important and very popular.
Yeah,
constitutional proposition. So watching this, because I think people are really familiar with this idea of the relational database, or the popularity based moving body of knowledge that swings in terms of popularity. It's really been amazing to watch, and then also to even think about how the letters from Resident Thinkers might impact the next level of constitutional propositions as different issues are brought to the fore through those weekly releases. And it struck me that in many ways the global warming seems to have been the generative impulse for the piece, but in a lot of ways it seems kind of more implicit within the project now, while the citizenship, nationhood, migration, and other issues are sort of more explicitly explored. So I wanted to know your opinion on this artistic strategy around the global warming piece being almost, not really a subtext, but a bit of the foundation for these other issues to become discussed on top of it. And I wondered if it had to do with the greater potential for audiences to engage with these issues in which they have a greater sense of agency, perhaps, on the level of shared experiences. Did you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, it's incredibly astute, actually. I think there's something really interesting there, which is that I went to the Arctic with Alex, and this expedition team made up of all these really interesting people and some young people as well we took with us from two of the schools. And one of the things that's very interesting is that we took almost exactly the same route that Alex had taken on the Cape Farewell expedition in 2004. Now, Cape Farewell's, I'm sure many of you know, but it's an organization dedicated to cultural responses to climate change. So that is what they do. They're absolutely dedicated to taking writers and artists and choreographers and musicians along with key scientists on sort of joint ventures and expeditions to the high Arctic, and they've been doing it since 2001, I think. And out of that have come all sorts of cultural responses, from Rachel White-Reed's piece in the Turbine Hall in Tate Modern to Ian McEwan's book Solar. And Cape Farewell are fantastic in their approach because it's a very open brief. They really allow the artist to just develop the work that fits with their own practice, and out of that comes a particular take on what they've experienced. And I think one of the difficulties with artists' responses to climate change from perhaps other projects not associated with Cape Farewell is that they can become very literal. There is a sort of notion that an artist will make a work about climate change and will take a very particular political position on climate change, and that work is supposed to come with a message about our future and how we can mitigate against this disaster. And of course, most of the works that have come out of Cape Farewell, they're certainly not that literal, they're not that straightforward. I mean, Ian McEwan's book Solar actually was far more about the relations between people in a very small space of a sailing boat on an expedition than it was about climate change. And I think what's interesting to think about with Alex Hartley is that his actual response was less to do with the aesthetics of the Arctic, which often colours a lot of work that comes out of those kinds of situations. So the icy glaciers, the melting ice, etc. And actually he was much more interested in the endeavour of polar explorers, the sort of failed aspirations, and the history of prospecting, of fights over mining rights, of territorial arguments, and how the history of that place is very strongly shot through with the same kind of global crises that we're experiencing now. So when we went on the expedition in September, I experienced firsthand exactly what Alex meant and how it related to his own practice in regards to territorial boundaries and architectural interventions within space. And particularly areas like, for example, a little town called Barentsburg, which is a Russian settlement that still mines for coal, and the territorial discussions that were going on as we were out there between the Russians, the British, the French, and the Norwegians about mining rights and the seabed. So for no island to come out of that, literally, it emerged from the melting ice of a glacier, it was implicated by the melting glacier, by climate change, but it's also implicated in terms of territorial fights that are going on over that particular area of land. And that's, if you look on the origin section of the embassy online, Noah Island, the origins of Noah Island are that it comes from a place that is deeply contested. It's a contested zone of our world and deeply implicated by all of our own actions. And the other thing that had a big influence on our decision and development of the work and the embassy and the resident thinkers was Tamsin Omond, who is an environmental campaigner. She's director of Climate Rush. So she's committed to mitigating against the results of climate change and changing. In fact, she came by cargo ship. She didn't fly. It took her 2.5 weeks to get there instead of our 2 days. But her point was, the problem is with how climate change is discussed in a work like Noah Island is it's seen almost that it's an issue with no connection to anything else. Whereas what she was saying is, in fact, of course, these are all global interconnected issues. So migration is connected to climate change, and climate change is connected to territorial rights and land grab, and land grab is connected to human migration. And so I think that's why it became very clear to us that this is not simply an artwork about climate change. This is an artwork about global crises and about it's a work of its time and therefore highly pertinent to be a work that has a presence in at a time of the Olympic Games and international exchange in the UK.
And you were very hands-on in terms of working with Alex, and also you've written about your approach to curation in that it goes beyond the idea of project management, and this is something that I really agree with. But I'm interested to know what you think about the historically established roles of artist and curator and how they're changing. Maybe in the long term, what are the implications of this more collaborative model?
Of course. I've written recently about the term producer, public art producer, and how in the performing arts that term is understood as being very creative and collaborative, and that it comes with a capacity for intellectual thought and for an understanding of the history of performance, but it also comes with a dynamism and understanding of charismatic agency that allows for performing arts projects to exist in the public realm. In the visual arts, it's much more difficult. If you talk about producer, people tend to think of you simply as a logistical project manager facilitating the artist's wishes. And it's curator, the term curator, that possesses these qualities of intellectual integrity and an understanding of working with the artist. So, I mean, other than it being semantics, my point is really is that I think the interesting thing that happens when producing public art projects is you cannot divorce the detail of logistics, whether that be working out the engineering of a 40-metre by 8-metre floating island from the Arctic, or whether that be working with the artists on this mobile embassy, or whether that be programming 52 resident thinkers. I have to, with my team here of producers, we have to be absolutely embedded in the ideas of the project. Now, Nowhere Island's a little bit unusual in that Alex regards us as a creative team, and therefore he's very, very generous about how he directs this project and how that's shared. It doesn't always happen that way. Sometimes you might work with a younger, less experienced artist who really want you to take the lead. In other cases, you might work with an artist who has a very clear vision from the beginning of what they want to do, and they see you much more as a sort of facilitator of that. But more and more, I'd say, particularly in the public realm, our job is to negotiate, to find ways of making the work really live, and that means translating the idea into different contexts. An example of that would be in Oslo. We were given the opportunity to have a vision for Oslo Harbour, the public art programme of Oslo Harbour. And rather than coming up with a series of works that would be installed, say, over a year or so across the harbour, we proposed a project that would unfold over around 7 years, which would involve different kinds of social projects. So, for example, Amy Franceschini from California is working with her group Future Farmers towards the development of a public bakehouse, which will be built on the harbour. But that unfolds over a temporary project with a mobile oven project that will go across Oslo over that period of time. Now, for that to happen, it requires us here in Bristol, in situations, and our producer in Oslo to work with Amy in a very collaborative way and to have ideas all the time. So we might be throwing things back to her, and then she throws things over to us. And that's how the project gets enriched, I think, and sort of lives off the page, because we also have to listen to people on the ground. So in Oslo, for example, the first thing that our colleagues in Oslo said is, well, don't forget, it snows 4 months of the year. So you Californian artist, you, it's all very well you coming over here with your ideas, but how on earth is this going to work? So, of course, one of the first things we did was talk about how it could be built so that the roof of the bakehouse becomes a seating area that's heated through the oven. So it then becomes a gathering point to keep warm. So, you know, but there's, you know, and I think part of that is just sort of shaping it. But I think the answer for a lot of these projects is that you build through them and around them these programs of engagement, whether that's events or talks or letters or online activity, which just makes them a bit more generous, really, and builds an anticipation for something occurring and a sense of excitement and collective activity around them. And for that to happen, the artist has to be willing to listen and to collaborate on ideas. But I think in terms of going back to your question about curator, I think one of the best definitions of curator I've ever heard is going back to the museum curator, that you have a duty of care. I think we have a duty of care to the artist, to the eventual artwork and project, and to the audience. For me, that's an equal set of responsibilities. So at any one time, you have to retain that duty of care in your decision-making on how to deliver a project.
It's really interesting how integrated and the kind of narrative timeline that we've understood historically around exhibition making is the research, then the production, then the presentation, then the sort of interpretation or public programs kinds of things that would happen around a gallery-based project have broken apart and reintegrated into essentially interpreting the idea of the artwork to an audience, in fact, creating an audience, creating a public for the artwork, and then launching it into this context that, as you say, has been anticipating it or has been prepared or has even perhaps challenged it, say in the case of the Nowhere Island Constitution. I mean, I'm sure that some of the propositions that came forward really had an impact on your team and on the artist and said, well, geez, I didn't anticipate.
Definitely. Yeah.
And it seems to me that that is quite a bit more appropriate approach for working in public space where the idea of an artwork, people may or may not anticipate art in public space. They may or may not recognize it as art within public space because of the framing of the gallery or the institutional legitimation is not necessarily there. So yeah, I'm especially with Nowhere Island, it's a very exciting to see kind of on the ground. And I guess that's another layer of being invested in how the project plays out, say for me and watching it over time, that as you observe, you know, I haven't proposed any constitutional.
Yeah, there you go.
Kind of one of those people that sits back and observes it, but the level of my investment or interest just continues to grow.
Oh, well, that's great to hear. And I mean, I think that it's good to sit back and observe too. You know, I think the other thing is I was having this big debate with someone the other day about participation, and there's this kind of emphasis that, you know, you have to be doing. And it's like, actually, it's okay also to see things unfold and be enjoying, you know, like when I read a newspaper, I don't particularly want to post a comment on the newspaper's website. You know, I just want to read it so and think about it and maybe share it, you know. So I think it's also fine to create a forum in which people are enjoying seeing that unfold. I mean, of course, the risks ahead are that if we are producing projects in this way, which have a less clear start, middle, and end, and are durational, are unfolding over different time frames and involving different people in different places, how are artworks distinguished from anything else? And perhaps some people might say, well, does that matter, you know, that you're just contributing to contemporary culture? The only reason it might matter is because does it simply become subsumed into entertainment like everything else? And are you trying to shout as loud as commercialized culture? And I've certainly seen that happen with Flash Mob. That's a kind of good example of where it began as something quite radical interventionist and was very quickly assimilated into consumer culture. And I think the same could happen with something like Nowhere Island, where you can just imagine a campaign running about, you know, if you would start New Nation, where would you begin for anything, Coca-Cola or anything else. So I guess the question is, how do we retain its political efficiency, if you like, or effectiveness? And certainly that's where I see the artist becomes forefront about deciding what is and isn't right for the project. But it's also that, and the playwright David Edgar wrote a great piece actually lately on what it is that the arts do that the creative industries don't do. And partly it's about creating this space in which it's possible to think and act as if things were different. So as opposed to the creative industries, which you could say is about developing, you know, very radical ideas that may then become subsumed by commercial culture, you could say that the arts are sort of counter that, that they have the possibility of being critical about how our society is run, offering other models of how things are doing. And I see Noah Island very much within that vein, that of course it's a utopia, of course the island will cease to exist, but it does offer us a model to think about the society that we currently have and how we relate to each other, as most utopian artworks do. So I think that that's the difference. And if we as producers can keep our eye on that, perhaps, of how to retain that space for artworks to be really effective, to be really socially progressive, and to offer us some sort of creative illusion of how things might be different.
It's interesting, too, how the relationship that, of different audiences to the work, or actually it's difficult to determine where the work is located. And there's something within the mobility of that, that when, as you point out, there's a lot of very exciting potential in that. There's a potential for danger as well. I think for me, there's the questions around authorship and who really becomes the author of this project. And there's an incredibly beautiful creative tension within the project. On the other hand, it resists, you know, when you're talking about the potential for our audience to just observe or to undermine in a sense, or so that resists the possibility of the work just becoming spectacle. And of course, a lot of these techniques that you're using can be easily appropriated, but they are actually, in fact, you have appropriated them. It's, you know, the like and the not like.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. They're very familiar.
Yeah, they're very familiar in that way. So it in itself, it's a much more complex terrain, I think.
Well, also the island, of course, I mean, if you can imagine, I don't know if this has come through the project, is that when it's in Weymouth, it's there for the opening of the sailing events of the Olympic Games, and it's part of something called Maritime Mix, which is the cultural Olympiad by the sea. And there's all sorts of producers and arts organisations involved. And of course, the pressure is, you know, what kind of spectacle will Noah Island be amongst all these other celebrations, many of which are fantastic, you know, and they involve lots and lots of young people, and, you know, it will be a real sense of carnival. But of course, Alex isn't that kind of artist. And so in this text that I've mentioned before around what is our type of public art producing, we're not really our outdoor arts producers, you know, so we won't be shooting fireworks off it or have a music gig on it. But you can understand why, to some people, they think, why wouldn't you do that? You know, it's the most fantastic platform and it'll be brilliant and everyone will love it and they'll all come out and enjoy themselves for the night. So it's kind of, you know, you have, that's where you have to be really, really clear about what it is that the artists are doing, that it's a territory nobody can go on. It's pretty alien. It's pretty barren. It comes from the Arctic. It doesn't have palm trees on it, you know. So it will seem like a very alien piece of landscape against the Jurassic coast. And also that the welcome ceremony for it is a citizen march. It's not a parade, it's a march. And therefore it's political, you know, and it will stand out as being quite different. The mobile embassy will be there as well. And that's not to say there won't be enjoyable events and activities and all sorts of things, because of course there will. But I think it's about saying that should be able to exist with these other outdoor arts celebrations and activities as part of our culture. It's not saying one's better than the other, but just to be clear, I think, about that there should be a space for artists to produce work which has a bit of tension according to that kind of public festival and spectacle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm quite intrigued by my sense of it always being somewhat in the distance, and I guess that's probably informed by how it has been photographed and that kind of thing. But yes, this sense of yearning and the sense of expectation and enunciation and that he's working with, just in terms of how to represent it.
And it is that, you've got it absolutely right, it is that sense that you can never quite get there. And there's a wonderful film, I don't know if you've seen it, but this is an example of a resident thinker who comes at it from a completely different point of view. It's a performance artist called Hugh Hughes, which is actually a pseudonym for his real name. But he's made this little film that you can watch online, and it's about a journey to get on to Nova Island. And it perfectly sums up this kind of impossible journey and how you get there. And you can have a watch of it.
I certainly will. Well, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.